Thank you, Ellis. And I'd like to make one announcement next Sunday afternoon here at the Day by Day group at 3 p.m. Agnes R. from Anniston, Alabama will be our speaker. You're cordially invited, and we hope you'll come and visit with us. I have a treat for myself today to introduce this lady that's going to speak to us. In 1974, I was at Panama City at the roundup, and my wife and I was there, and I saw this lady sitting over there. I said, "Now there is somebody that radiates this program." I had not met her. She exemplified what I thought the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was. This lady's name was Rose B. from Montgomery. The following year, I had the privilege of going to Cuthbert, Georgia. And there I met a lady that I said to my wife, "There is another Rose B." Because she exemplifies and radiates the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never heard June speak. But by looking at her and just watching her in the program of AA, she doesn't have to say anything. She radiates this light that we find, this gift that we have given to us through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been looking forward to this because when I first met Rose, she had a problem in her life, in her physical life. And she was not ready to travel. And I'll let her tell you about this. Probably she will. Without taking up any more of her time, it's really a privilege. And I'm going to sit back and listen. And I hope you'll help me cordially welcome June D. from Lumpkin, Georgia.
What an honor. Can't go through with it. I'm June Duke, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, June.
For the benefit of the press, radio, and film, it's spelled D-U-K-E. I have no anonymity. Better some of these books so I can play with something. I'm glad to be here today, and I'm very flattered, too. I had a very good sponsor when I did come into this program, and I still do some of the things he told me to do. He said, "The first thing you do is give your sobriety date." And he said, "And hell, it wouldn't hurt you to give your birthday." He says, "Because everybody be figuring about how old you are and when you were sober." So I was born on June the 29th, 1920. And if you subtract, like I do, 20 from 78, makes me 48 years old. And I found this program on March the 10th, 1960. And for the glory and the grace of God, I have not seen fit to take a drink since. Now, I don't know that you would count me addicted to dope, too, but I was in the bank, and I was drinking 4 pints of whiskey every day. From the time I left the bank until I got there the next morning. And then during banking hours, I had tranquilizers and ammonia, I imagine gallons and gallons of ammonia. Spirits of ammonia, I drank that during the day, which I will go into later. I started off in life mixed up. My father was from Lumpkin, born and raised in Lumpkin, and my mother was a damn Yankee, and he was working in Minnesota at the time. She was a Michigander. And they lived in Chicago, and my brother and I were born in Chicago. I was 3 and he was 5. And he kidnapped us one night, and in later years, just these later years, I found that when I was growing up, I kind of blamed him, you know, for taking us away from my mother. He brought us back to Lumpkin to his sister. And my Aunt Martha and my Uncle Arthur T. raised me. It was about a year after I had gotten adjusted to her that he remarried. And he took my brother and me. And I lived with him and my stepmother about 2 weeks, and I must have given her almighty hell. In the meantime, Aunt Martha was suffering, wanting me back. So I've got a letter at home I read once in a while with gratefulness that my daddy wrote to his sister and said, Martha, if you want Jean, come get her. Because Clara May, my stepmother, cannot tolerate her any longer. And if you happen to not want her, we will get together and put her in, I say silence. Wound up there. And off and home. Of course she wanted me. And from that day on, she raised me. Now, I was, give you one guess what kind of home I was raised in. Anybody. I was raised in a Christian home. That's bad for the alcoholic, but I was. Now, I never wanted for anything, materially, in any way. He was the local banker and had his finger on a lot of other things, and I grew up with feeling an indebtedness for what they had done for me. As I said, I really never wanted for anything. And my goal in life was to never disappoint them, whatever I did, whatever walk of life, whatever I did, I would never disappoint Aunt Martha and Uncle Arthur T. Well, I went to college, and I came back, and he put me in the bank, and I was there 25 years. Now, when I was 22 years old, she was still writing my letters for me, love letters for what. I was very mature and dating the cream of the crop. I didn't know really too much about whiskey. We were talking about writing down, and I said, I know they did that in high school, but I was never associated with it. My father drank, he has been sober since 1937. But I was not raised. He would come to Lumpkin to see me on occasions, and I remember as a child, the next morning after spending the night, he would take me to school. And how embarrassed I was, because he was pretty well loaded from the time he got there until he left, and 24 hours a day at that time. I remember that part of drinking, how embarrassed it was. I had an uncle, several uncles, in fact, everybody except this aunt and my family that I know can remember, drank alcoholically. My father was my grandfather was a country doctor, one of the best. Alcoholic, died. Suicide, several others the same way. And that was all I could think about for myself when I started drinking. Well, it was just a thing for me to do. It was just about time for me to commit suicide. I got so desperate. But when I was 22 years old, Aunt Martha said, I think you should go meet your mother. Well, I that was one of the turning points in my life, because it was the first thing I had ever done without her. But they put me on the train, and I headed to Chicago. I didn't know what I was going to see. I didn't know what she looked like. But I remember meeting my mother at the first time, and it was along in here that I remember that I started to take that first drink. I was dating before then, some boys, the Lumpkin girls would date the Richland boys of Twin City, and vice versa. And I would always drive them home. I'd put the boys out in Richland, and I'd come on back and put the ones in Lumpkin out, and just leave the car parked in front of the house, and they'd get it the next day. And that was regular routine with me. I just never did think about drinking. It just never entered my mind. And it looks like to me that I could remember the very first drink, but I cannot remember the first drink that I took. I remember the period, and that was right about when I was 22 years old. And I remember coming back from this visit with my mother and how glad I was to see Aunt Martha, because she was so far different than I was, and nothing about it seemed like she was my mother. And yet there was something there. I was confused again. But I drank, maybe if there's such a thing as social drinking, I drank socially for 2-3 years. And of all the drastic, terrible things that I did do, the first thing that I did to hurt this dear lady was marry the town drunk. Now, he had been divorced. He had had 5 trips to Bronner Sanitarium with DTs. But he loved me, and I felt sorry for him. And he told me he never would drink again, so I married him. In October, 45. Well, in December, about 2 months later, he got drunk. Well, that was awful. I didn't know how to cope with a drunk. I know I gave up my social drinking. That didn't do any good. I got drunk and drunk. So off to Bronner Sanitarium he went. But this time he went, and when he came back, he never drank again until he died 13 years later. Now, a year and a half, almost 2 years passed. There was no whiskey around, and he was not drinking. He came in one day with a fifth of whiskey, and he put this whiskey on the kitchen table. He said, "Now, you used to enjoy a social drink, and I want you to still enjoy it because I'm not going to drink anymore." And I believed him again, and this time he didn't, but I did. He said, "There are a lot of days you come home from the bank tired and need a pickup." So there were quite a few years there that I came home awful tired and needed a heap of pickup. Awful. I was overworked. I was tired. I had to come home and cook supper, you know, and I was tired. That fifth lasted a good while. But then the next one didn't last but about a week, and then, as you know, how that goes. But now you're looking at a lady drunk. Now, I was one of these lady drunks. Now, if you've ever seen a woman with 3 pints in a lady, I'd like to see her, but that's what I was. I drank at home, and I did do most of my drinking at home. And a lot of the drinkers gathered around to drink with me, but I was always at home. And in April of 59... Well, I lost my uncle in 55, and that was an excuse. That my drinking progressed a little bit more then. And in April of 59, 4 years later, my husband was sitting in the den there when I got home from the bank. And I put my pocketbook down and went straight in the kitchen like I always did to get the bottle. He said, "Wait just a minute before you go in there." I thought, "Oh, Lord, he's listening to the feel of my drinking." And he was buying it for me. He said, "Have you just got to have that drink this afternoon?" I said, "No, I don't have to have it." And he said, "Well, I just want to tell you that if anything happens to me, will you promise me when you get to be an alcoholic that you'll go to Bronner?" And you see, we knew nothing at all of AA then, nothing. And I said, "Yes, I promise." And I went straight on in the kitchen and got the jug. Well, he died in June. Now, my loss was terrific. I was living alone then after he died. my grief was heavy. And I was very dramatic with it. When I would come from the bank, I would get my bottle and I'd get at least a pint in me. Then I'd get me another bottle and a pitcher of ice water and go down to the cemetery and just sit there, you know, and drink. And one of my best friends that I grew up with came down there one day and he's got that bottle and told me to get in that car. He was a policeman at the time. He says, "You go home." He says, "You're not grieving. You're not doing a thing but being very dramatic," which was true. So I went on home. Well, in the meantime, these next few months, I was very dramatic. I had people feeling sorry for me, but I still stayed at home. Now, some of the boys and girls would call at the bank. "We're going to Eufaula. That's where we got our whiskey. How many?" And I'd say 10 or 12 or a case. And the very few times I had to go, but when I did have to go get my own whiskey, I went with my knees just like this all the way, and I would drive back to the city of Lumpkin before I would take a drink. I had some complex about driving and drinking. And I was blessed that I didn't do it but the one time. But this fella came in one night with a bunch of us playing the organ and piano, and we were having a good time and everybody drinking. And I started dating him. And he asked me to marry him, and I thought, well, now that'd be just a trick. I won't have any problem getting the whiskey now. And that was my only thought at the time. Now, I was pretty well in the depths of alcoholism then. In fact, our local doctor was too, and he was giving me, I'll step back just a minute, my husband, before he died, had built up the Sunday school class from about 12 to 60. And we were working with, I'd work with him, even though I was half drunk every night. We'd get those people to Sunday school every morning. And after he died, of course the Sunday school class went down, and I did not continue his work with it. See, I got a mental block, I would have backed up for it, Ray. But after he died, I called the Sunday school teacher one morning at 2 o'clock. And I said, "What you doing?" And she said, "Well, I've gone to bed." And I said, "Well, I sure am sorry. I didn't have any idea what time it was. 2 o'clock in the morning." So the next morning before I went to the bank, Aunt Martha called me. She said, "Jim, what in the world do you mean calling Addie Humble at 2 o'clock in the morning to talk to her about the Sunday school class?" I said, "Who said I did?" She said, "She did." I said, "Well, she told you a lie." Well, it wasn't but a few days, got my phone bill, and I had several calls on that to Japan. And my brother was stationed in Japan at this time. And I put in a call to him, and I didn't remember. Well, I started writing down. Every time I picked up that telephone, I started writing down everybody I rang. And I got to where I couldn't read it. The next morning, couldn't read my writing. I was getting bad shape. And I'd look, and I'd go, "Who was this I called?" And I couldn't read it. One of them was a Baptist preacher. Nearly about every night I called a Baptist preacher, and I'm a Methodist. And he told me about it later. However, I've always said I was about 20% Baptist anyway. But I could always kind of get that brother brand in where I could read it. But I was getting in just that rat race at the time. So I was also having trouble getting my whiskey, because when they'd bring me a case of whiskey, they'd all come down and drink it, and I'd be with that. And old Generous June, you know, at that time I didn't hide it as much, because I knew they'd go the next day. Well, some days they didn't. So I thought, well, I'll just marry this fella. He'll at least buy my whiskey. So I married him. And I won't ever forget, we married over Troy, Alabama. And God was with me. I married a paranoid schizophrenic. But he came from a lovely family, and I love his family today. But he happened to be the black sheep. And he was crazy. And a chronic alcoholic, and I didn't know that because I was drinking myself, and just as much in the depths probably as he was, I hadn't at this time gone into DTs or I was forgetting I was at that blackout stage and had been for some time. But we were coming back a couple of months after we'd married from Ozark to Lumpkin. And we were almost into Eufaula one night, and the car just went slowly off the road. I looked over, and he passed out of the wheel. And I cut the ignition off, and I thought, well, my God, I'm married to an alcoholic. What am I going to do? Well, I was just sober enough to get up under the wheel, and this was the only time that I remember driving and drinking. And I got stopped in Eufaula, running the red light. And he was passed out. And I was half drunk. And I told them that I had problems, and they let me go anyway, and I got on the Lumpkin. Well, I got so bad at and with him drinking like he was and such a problem, that worried me. Because I really didn't know he was an alcoholic. I didn't know he was anything. I didn't even know he was a man when I married him. Didn't care. It was in February that I told him in the bank I had the flu, and I had made up my mind to quit drinking. So I went home, and I had 10 pints of whiskey. And I took this whiskey, and I put 2 in a hat box. Now, I was always a hat lover. I loved to wear hats. And so I hid those, and I still had this organ, too. And there's a little place in the back of the organ that's perfect to hide whiskey, and I put two pints there. And I knew I wasn't going to be playing the piano anyway, and I had an upright piano, so I put 2 up there, top of the piano, and 2 under my mattress. And those are the ones I remember, except I poured a half of a pint and put it on the mantelpiece. And this dear, lifelong friend of Aunt Martha's, a local nurse there, I called her. And she had 2 girls my age that I grew up with, and I called her, and she came up there, and I said, I'm fixing to quit drinking. And there's the half a pint of the mantelpiece. I want you to come back this afternoon and see how I'm doing. And I remember, it stuck with me, though. She said, June, don't you need medical help? I said, no, I'm going to quit. So that afternoon, poor little thing hobbled up there. And there was that half a pint, not a drop out of. And I was drunk as a coot. I said, how am I doing? She says, you're doing all right. Just keep on till you drink every pint you've got here, and I'll come back. So, I did. Well, in the meantime, going way, way back when I was a child, this aunt also took another brother's bottle to raise. And he was a thorn in my side from the day I got to Lumpkin until he died just last year. And I would still have resentments. But he's gone. But he made my life miserable all the time I was growing up. And then when my uncle died, he took over the bank. And he really made my life miserable in the bank. Frankly, I think I was just a step smarter than he was. Because after I got sober, these bankers would come in. He would try to embarrass me. He did everything he could to get me drunk again. He'd say, you wouldn't think that she was a drunk, would you? He said, she used to do better work drunk than she does sober. And those were pretty bitter pills to swallow. I stayed 10 days at Browner's, and when I came in, he said, everybody figure the vacation's everybody but June. She just had one. She spent her vacation at Browner's. So all these things were pretty bitter pills. And then I found out, too, that he had a $500 bet that I'd be drunk in 6 weeks. Well, that bet, plus Dr. Browner, was the reason I came into AA. When I walked into I made up my mind that night that I just had to do something. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I could no longer be a lady. My feet were beginning to stink. You know, I know I washed them, but they're still a little bit black on the bottom after these 2 years. Rusty. I'd go barefoot. I thought it was so cute to go downtown and Lumpkin on the square barefooted when I'd get just a few drinks in me. And then I'd get in the yard. I worked in the yard barefooted. I did everything barefooted. I even get barefooted in the bank. And I think it was 2 years before my feet smelled like normal feet supposed to smell. I don't remember, but I remember the stunk. Oh. But our car picked up the phone. I hadn't had too much to drink. This was during that flu epidemic, you know. I was still out of the bank with the flu, trying to do something about my drinking. Now, after this time, up to this very point, I have on numerous occasions tried to contact Dr. James Brown. Never could get anything but the answering service. I'll call the next day. I'll get his nurse. But this particular night, I called Dr. Brown because I had promised my husband, who died, that I would. And that was all I could think of. And then Martha was in Miami. She was not there. And I was desperate. And I picked up the phone to call him, and he answered the telephone. And I said, told him who I was. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. He, that scared me to death. That's the first truth I had told in years. And he was very doubtful. He told me later that I was sincere. But he said, if you're here at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, I'll save you a room. And I said, well, I'll be there. Now, I had heard my husband say, now, before you go, get well fortified. But I was just the opposite. I didn't want to get too well fortified because this paranoid that I was married to, I knew would put me in there and keep me there, and I'd be there today. He carried me, and he was drunker than I was when we got there. He was awful, terrible shape. But I went in, and I signed myself in, and I told him. I said, now, Dr. Brown, I won't get straight. But I don't want to be in a room with anybody else because they start picking bugs off of them, I'm going to start picking them off of me. I'm just that way. He said, no, I've got your room up there. We got up to the room and they had bars on the window. And they took my suitcase. And I called him back. I said, now listen, I'm up here to get straight. But I want my suitcase in here. I know you can't do anything about these bars on the window, but I want my suitcase in my room. And he brought it back in the room, and the nurse said, well, that's the first time he's ever done that. But he had taken my pills out of the suitcase. He had taken my Listerine bottle and my razor blade, and I even resented that. I didn't like that. He'd asked me if I had ever attempted suicide, and I lied and told him no. But I did on one occasion in particular. When I found out what I was married to, I didn't really realize it until 3 months later when I was at Brownell. But subconsciously I did, and I thought, well, I'd just rather be dead. And I turned the gas on one night in the house and just lay down. I thought, well, this would be the quietest, best way to go. And if I'd have been just had one more drink, I'd have gone out that quiet, too. But it dawned on me, I might die. I got up and cut all of that gas off and opened up that house, but fast. So that was the end of the suicide. I didn't have a nerve. I was taking enough pills in the daytime for automatic to have done it. I know what I backed up about that Sunday school class for a while ago. He gave me a big bottle. It was thin pink stuff for your nerve. And about half of us drunks that were going to that big Sunday school class, they were all drinking, and one of them in particular called me one morning. He said, I'm shaking too bad to go. I said, no, you're not coming by here. I got some good medicine. I take it every Sunday morning. So he said, I'm not going to go with drinking whiskey. I said, no, this is nerve medicine. Just come by here. So he came by, and the next Sunday we had about a dozen in that table. And it was a tablespoonful, and it kind of quiet you. Hold your hands a little steady. And then we'll forget that. Mom and Frank said, well, shoot, look at that. I'm just as calm as I can be. Give me some more. And he took 4 tablespoons full and went to sleep in Sunday school class. But I was taking all of that and tranquilizers and, as I said, ammonia, besides the whiskey. And my average amount that I was drinking was 4 pints. And I didn't stop that until in the afternoon. I had a capacity. Not that I'm bragging, but it's really worse. I think it would have done that. It did do me more harm. But I got to Brownell's and I stayed 11 days. And when I was there the third day, Dr. Brownell came up the room and he said, there's a lady in Atlanta, Georgia, that's coming out. And this was Smyrna out of Atlanta. I 40, 50 miles. Direct. I don't know how far the burn is. But this was in March of 60. And she's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and wants to come talk to you. And I said, no, I cannot take on any more than I'm doing. I am a member of the Methodist Church in Lumpkin, and that keeps me busy enough. And whatever organization this is, I don't want it. And he said, well, you told me when you came here you wanted to cooperate. And she's already on her way, and it was snowing outside. Well, that impressed me to a degree, but not too much, because I certainly was not interested in anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. All I want to do is get the alcohol out of me and come on home. But that dear lady came, and it took her nearly 2 hours to get to Brawner that day. And I told this nurse, I had a nurse around the clock. I was scared to stay by myself. And I told her, I said, don't you leave this room, not even to go to the bathroom. Don't you leave this room for anything. I'm not going to be left alone with this woman. But she came in and sat, and she talked, and I remember, well, I started to say very little. I don't remember anything she said. I wasn't interested at all. And I told her, I said, I'm a member of the Methodist Church, and that's all I care to belong to right now, in the DAR. And she said, she left me some literature, and I didn't pick the literature up. But that was the third or fourth day I was there. Well, the tenth day, I told the nurse to go down and tell Dr. Bone I was going to leave. Well, this famous doctor that alcoholic doctor that we had in London at that time had his wife up there, and she had been there 9 months. She was on Demerol and whiskey and everything else. And he said, you've got to stay at least 6 months. So I panicked a little bit, and I thought, well, I signed myself in, I'm going to get out of here. So I remember going down in his office the next morning and telling him I was leaving, and I had a plant, a green plant in my hand. And you know, you could take a plant now and hold it in your hand, and the leaves would quiver just like this is here. It'll quiver. He says, look at you, you're shaking all over now. And of course, when he said that, they really did quiver. And he says, you'll be back in 6 weeks. So my goal was, with my cousin's $500 bet and Dr. Brown a betting, that I just was going to set a goal and I was going to stay sober. Hell or high water for 8 weeks and show them I was going to go over that 2 weeks. And that was all I had on my mind. When I got to Lumpkin, there was a letter there from this woman that came out to see me. And in this letter, she said, I do hope that you will see fit to look up one or any of these names. And she had gone to all the trouble. At that time, there was only one group in Columbus. And she gave me the name of who to call that one group in Columbus. There was one name in Cuthbert. She was just trying to find the nearest place to Lumpkin. And you follow. And it impressed me. And then my thoughts went back those few days that woman had driven in that snow all the way out there to see me. And I was desperate to the degree that I wanted to stay sober just 8 weeks. And I realized I couldn't do it, because my cousin was on my back, and this present husband was drunk every single day and passed out right about 5 o'clock every afternoon. I was in something that I didn't think I could get out of and stay sober and manage it. And I tell you today that if anybody, if you don't think you can certainly stay sober. It's harder for a woman maybe than a man. It was at that time, but I can tell you that if I did it, anybody can. That first year was awful. So I thought, well now, if it's just 8 weeks, I've been getting the whiskey and you follow, I'll just go to that meeting and you follow for 8 weeks and then I can get my whiskey. He just like I used to be. So I went to Eufaula and I called and Haywood answered the phone. Well, Haywood met me, Van Pan. And at that time, that particular time, there was only two men. He says, June, I tell you, you need to go to Cuthbert. He says, not any further distance, and go to Cuthbert. They're a little bit more active right now. And Jim and I both would meet you there every time you go. So I got home, and I called this man in Cuthbert. This lady in Atlanta gave me the phone number and everything. And some lady answered the phone, and she sounded sort of gruff. And I told her who I was and that I wanted to come to a meeting. That I thought I was an alcoholic, but I need to go and find out. And she said, just a minute, I'll let you talk to my husband. Well, that was the beginning of Ted. Ted answered the phone, and he said, yes, we have a closed meeting tonight. And he hemmed and hawed around, and I wondered why it was taking so long. And I said, well, I'll be there. It was sleeting. It was bad weather. And I got in the car by myself, went down there, and didn't know what I was getting into, didn't know I was going to get raped, knocked in the head, what was going to happen to me. I didn't know anything about the program. But I walked in. And one of the first persons I saw was sitting over to the right there was a fella that I dated in high school. Had not seen in 20 years and hadn't thought about in 20 years, and there he sat. Used to live at Lincoln. But Ted did talk that night, and I don't remember anything he said except that I knew I wanted it. And I was one of those many or few that walked right up to him and asked, had my checkbook out. I didn't have a dime, but I knew Aunt Martha did, and Dr. Brown, by the way, found out she did, and that was the reason he wanted me that for 6 months. But I wanted to pay him a year's advance for the membership of this program. And I didn't care if it was $5,000 or what it was. And Ted was my sponsor, and he really had his hands full, believe me, you, with me. Now, it just happened that after a few weeks, or it might have been a couple of months, I asked Ted one night, I said, am I the only woman drunk in the state of Georgia? He said, no, there's one more. He said, you go see her tomorrow. So he told me where to go and you follow. So I went to Eufaula to see the leader. And I didn't know what to say. And Ted wouldn't go with me. There's another one of the things as we go along that I did on my own. I just walked up and introduced myself. I said, I'm an alcoholic. She said, so what? What's your problem? I thought, well, fuck. I thought a minute, and I thought, well, now, what is my problem? I said, well, I can't forget yesterday, and I can't help but worry about tomorrow. She said, well, hell, that's the reason you were drunk. And that was everything she said to me. I got home and I called Ted. I said, I don't know what kind of woman you sent me to, but she's not an alcoholic. And he laughed. He had a laugh. He laughed at that until his death. He told me to stick to the women's. And I did. I stuck to him and the others in the group that had as much as 2 years sobriety anyway. He told me to call him, and I called him some nights 3 and 4 times, some mornings at 2 o'clock, but I called him. I went to any lengths to get this program because I wanted it. And I think that's the only way anybody can get it, to go to any lengths to get it. And many a time I rolled out of that bed at 2 o'clock in the morning, I did last weekend, rolled out at 2 o'clock. The husband I'm married to now, non-alcoholic, and he just can't understand how I roll out of the bed to go have a drink. He just doesn't understand this alcoholism. But things going back were so rough. I had a cook, still had the same cook, and we had the restaurant at that time, and the bank was next door to the restaurant. I was just like this, from the bank to the restaurant, bank to the motel. And he'd park himself about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in front of one of those motel rooms. We couldn't have rented a motel room if we wanted to, because it'd get sloppy and slobber, and his head would get a little bit tilted, and about it'd get to a certain angle. And my cook said, okay, Miss June, we can get him now. And we'd run out there and get him and carry him and put him to bed. Well, you know my sponsor, Ted didn't like it. He didn't like J.T. at all. And he just could not see how even calling him sometimes like I did that I could stay sober with that. But one night I was kind of depressed, and he had made it to the shower stall. And he slumped down in the shower stall, and I couldn't budge him, and I couldn't wake him up, and he just passed out there. And there on the kitchen table were two bottles with some in it, and I grabbed those and dumped them out right quick, and those unopened bottles didn't seem to bother me. They were... But I went on to the telephone. I said, Ted, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm just about had all I can take. I was maybe six, 8 months in the program then. I said, JT's in the shower stall, passed out, drunk. I'm at the end of my way. He said, June, let me tell you what. And this helped me as much as anything he ever said at that time. He said, you go in there where he is in that shower stall, and you turn on that wall, cold, and you stand there and pray that son of a bitch drowns. Every fear left me, and I got hysterical. I called the cook and told her to come up here and get him, and I told her what he had told me, and she said, well, you know, Miss June, that's pretty good fun. But we got him out of there. But I had problems from then on until he died. After his death, I married Carl, and he's a non-alcoholic. He doesn't understand AA. He'll come to the programs, and he'll bring me a lot of times when it's bad weather rather than go. But he tells me a lot of times that if I tell him I'm going to talk. Last night I said, I'm going over to Dothan tomorrow afternoon. You want to go? He said, well, if Ray doesn't go with you, I'll go. But he says, I tell you, I hear you in the den every night. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you're going to talk over at Dothan tomorrow, you won't be home at midnight. Mm-hmm. But he's pretty good. But once or twice, he had told Aunt Martha that he says, I just don't believe June's an alcoholic. She never drinks it. She doesn't have it right. She doesn't think about it. And she said, just don't you ever think for a minute she's not. She's so afraid he will think that I'm not an alcoholic and my stinking thinking might come back. So she convinces him more than I do that I am an alcoholic. But is that some sort of bell for me? Shut up.
That's stinking telephone.
But when I got into this program and went to any lengths to get it, which I did do, I even asked one of the boys and you that didn't crochet and do needlepoint. I said, what do you do between times, between meetings to stay sober? He says, I plant a red petunia patch. And he says, I just get out there and work it with a spoon. And I thought, well, I'll do that. Everything they did, I did it. It didn't matter what it was. And for 18, nearly 19 years now, I've been planting a red petunia patch. And a couple of years ago, on my birthday, there was a lady in Albany who made me a little scarecrow. And on the scarecrow, it said, the bugs stay out of June's petunia patch. So I keep that little thing out there in my petunia patch every year. So it's gotten now to be, I'm a little superstitious. I'm scared not to plant with red petunias. But any lengths to get it, I did. But going back one more time to my drunkalog, this dear aunt that I love so dearly more than I do anything, I guess, on earth, she's 82 now, and we're very, very close. And she came to see me one morning after we had had a ring-tail doodle of a brawl at my house. Everybody that drank in Lumpkin was there that night. And when we started out of the door, when some of them started out around 4 o'clock in the morning, the door locked on them. There was a great big key, and the key was right there. Nobody saw the key. We just got the foot and kicked the door down, and glass went everywhere and cut my leg. So the doctor had been gone about an hour, too drunk to stay any longer. But I called him, got him up. He came right in and put the clamps on my leg. And that morning when my cook came, I could hear coming in my back door, crush, crunch, 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 all of that glass. Glass was in the trees, looked like diamonds. Glass all over the steps, glass everywhere. And I don't know how so much glass out of one door could have scattered some. She called Aunt Martha and said, something's wrong. Miss June ain't going to the bank today. And there's blood out on the porch, there's glass everywhere, so poor Aunt Martha hobbled down. And she walked in there that morning. She was white as a sheet. And tears rolling down her cheek. And my heart ached. And she said, June, I would do anything in the world for you if you just would get straight. She said, if it meant selling everything that I had, if you just would get straight. And I looked at her and I said, get out of here. And she slowly walked out, and that was when my heart broke. When I stood in the window and saw her walking up the street with her hands behind her and sobbing, it nearly killed me. And it was about 2 months after that I did go to Bronner's. I think that was the beginning, the end there. But after a couple of months, I got the grapevine. And I remember in the back one day, I had the grapevine out and was reading it, and this old maid was sitting there. And I worked in the bank. And I think Sarah would know who I'm talking about, but name is Susie. And she says, June, I've never seen anything help anybody like AA has helped you. She says, you picked up 12 pounds? I had. They told me to eat Hershey bars. So I bought Hershey bars, a case for the bank, a case for the cafe, and a case of Hershey bars at home. Now, they said, every time you want a drink, eat a Hershey bar. Well, I had a case in the bank and a case in the cafe and a case at home, and I wanted a drink every 5 minutes, and I was eating Hershey bars every 5 minutes. And I was eating. And so was Susie. Eating. And she said, she had read that grapevine. And she said, I sure would like to go down there. She said, how much would I have to drink to Joan? And that's how well I was progressing. But I tell you, about four or five years of sobriety, I went to the meeting one night, and Ted and his wife were very cool. That word, because I was very dependent on Ted. And I was a spoiled brat. He told me that all the time. He gave me some pretty rough. He didn't bathe in it altogether. And I got home and I told him off. I said, something's bad wrong. If anything happens, if I've done anything to them and they're not friendly with me anymore, I'll just have to quit going. Of course, that told her all. She says, June, just get in your car and go right back and ask them. So I got in the car and turned right around and went right back to Custer. And I drove in the yard. When I did, he was standing in the yard just hysterical. He said, knew you was going to do it. I said, well, what is wrong? He said, we just figured it's time for you to be on your own. I said, all right, you figured that, buddy, but if you put me on my own, I'm going to quit. He said, you're just fool enough to do it. So, of course, everybody predicted that I was going to really pitch drunk when Ted died. He lived 8 years after I got in the program. I was 8 years sober when I came in. I might have it a little bit confused. No, and he was sober 8 years with me. He was as good a sponsor as you can have. I had a co-sponsor. at that time. Some of you might remember Rowett, who was a Baptist preacher. So I took Rowett. And it seemed that all my sponsors were dying, so I just was without a sponsor. And Martha got sick a couple of years ago, and I panicked. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? As much as I love the people in the program, they don't really know just what she means to me. I've got to have a sponsor. So I very timidly asked Gray in Columbus one night. I realized I had been without one for about a year. And I was going to make him think it wasn't going to be anything to it, you know. I said, would you sponsor me? And he said, yeah, sure would. I came home, told him off. I said, I done got me another fool now. I said, Ray's going to sponsor me. I said, he sure doesn't know what he's going to get himself in. She said, he sure doesn't. He sure doesn't. And poor thing, he sure doesn't. But I'm going to call him. Now, some of you are thinking right now, maybe some of you might not have it a few weeks or a month, sobriety, or a year. But I need it just as bad today as I did in March of 1960. I hope that I'll never, I hope I'll be around, I used to say I hope I'll be around this program when I'm old and gray. But I hope now I'll be around when I'm on crutches and hobbling along and shaking with palsy. Because I reckon I'm old and gray now, but this program is my life. You've got to attend meetings. You've got to go to meetings. I firmly believe, I don't want to try it. I've seen too many fail. That if I don't go to a meeting, if I should happen not to go for, say, 2 months or less to my AA meeting, I know that I would get drunk. Now, I know that I would. Now, you think that, well, she's got several years one day at a time. She's got it made. Far, far from it. If I went a couple of months without an AA meeting, I firmly believe that I would get drunk. Without you people. You're holding me up. And even though I might not can stick to many winners now, you're the winner for me. All the newcomers that come in are the ones that help me now. I know it hadn't been just 2 or 3 years, very few years ago. I don't remember how many years one day at a time of sobriety I had, but enough of this shouldn't have happened to me, but it did. I was sitting in the den one night, and I was alone that night, and I never did drink beer when I was drinking. I drank whiskey, the neck of the bottle, chased it with a cigarette, most of it. But they were pouring beer on this television, and my mouth just walked. This was before Ted died, so it had to be a few more years later than that. But my mouth watered, and it wasn't after he died. They said, use footwork, do anything, but don't take that drink. And this was about midnight. So, it had rained in Lumpkin about a week at that particular time. It had poured. And you just walk out on the lawn and you just bogged down in it. It had rained really that much. Well, I picked up my crochet. That didn't satisfy me. My mouth just watered that much more. I thought, well, I believe this is it. I'm going to take that drink. I picked up the big book and I read a little bit in the big book. I couldn't get the answer there. And said, do footwork. And I just got up desperately and went outside at midnight and started watering the grass. And I was bogging down in it at the water. And right about the time I got the hose going, the night policeman stopped me. He said, Miss June, is everything all right? I said, yeah, everything's all right. I'll tell you about it tomorrow. Well, he goes home from his night duties at 8 o'clock in the morning. Do you know that he was in that restaurant the next morning at 8 o'clock wanting me to explain to him? It's that much curiosity what was wrong. I said, hell, I wanted a drink of whiskey. The worst way. And I said, that's the only thing. And I said, and you come along asking me what was wrong with me, did it? Because I realized just how silly I looked, but I didn't. One time I didn't care. I really didn't care. So I don't think it matters what we do if we stick our heads in a well. If we do anything but take that drink. Regardless, as the book says, go to any length to get it. And that's what I have tried to do. Just go to any length to get it. And to love you people. Oh, very dearly. There's no love in the world like the love of a fellow alcoholic to me. And I've always been a lovable person. AA has love, if you want it, it's here. We have faith. I don't know if we've got the faith that my nun has got. She gave out a gas. And she looked up the road about 100 yards and saw the filling station up there, so she walked up there to the filling station and said she was out of gas. And he told her that he didn't have anything to put it in. But if she could find something to put the gas in, he'd be glad to get the gas. So the nun saw this trash pile over there and, so she went over there to it and she looked and hunted and she looked and she found an old chamber. Now my minister is one that talks with his hands and he was describing the chamber when he was telling me the joke, you know, the chamber. Said she wiped it off real good and cleaned it up good and poured it full of gas and she hightailed it up the road to her car. And as she was pouring the gas into the car from this chamber, this fellow in this big diesel truck stopped and he looked and his mouth just blew open. When she got through pouring the gas, put the top on the car and put the chain in the back of the car and she looked around and he said, lady, I hope someday I'll have your kind of faith. So I think if we've got that kind of faith in this program, and the love, we can make it one day at a time. Now, there were some days that I had to work it 1 hour at a time. And when they told me to eat those Hershey bars, instead of getting that one case, I put one in the bank and one in the cafe and one at the house, and they didn't last too long. I did everything they told me to do. And I never did weigh but 99 pounds to 102 pounds in my life until I got in this program. And one night I was making a 12-step call, and this poor little gal didn't weigh but 85 pounds. She looked it. And she was not in too good a shape for me to make a 12-step call, too, but I went. And she said, well, now, she kind of talked through her nose. She said, I just want to ask you one thing. If I do go into this AA, will I get as fat as you are? And I said, no, you won't get as fat. I thought maybe I'd stick her on some peppermint stick cane, and maybe that wouldn't be as fat. But I'd like to close with this last paragraph in the big book, page 164. If you haven't read it, read it. Read it again and again. I have started reading the book again. I don't know how many times I've read it. I'm glad I don't, because you might think I'm bragging if I said I'd read it 50 times or 20 times or what. But it's in this right here, your answer's here. The answer's here, and the answer is going to meet me. But I had started reading it this week, again, several times. And I have found new things in it again, after reading it over again. Abandon yourself to God as you understand Him, as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. we shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you cross the road of happy destiny. God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
Aren't we glad that we were able to trudge this road of destiny and meet Jim? Thank you so very much for coming over and sharing with us your strength and hope, Jim. Again today, you brought us a message of hope and faith and honesty and humility. God bless you. And thank you, Ray and Julia, for coming with her today. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Please respect other A members' names and story in a confidential manner. In layman's language, who you've seen here today, please leave here. And what you've heard here today, please leave here. We have the chip system in this group, and Dale, where are you sitting? Would you do the chips for us?